Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I've got a tremendous, guitar player and just a good guy, really successful in the music business. We're with Joel Hoekstra today. Joel lives in New York, and he currently plays for Whitesnake, Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and Cher. He's also well-known for his time spent with Night Ranger, the Broadway show Rock of Ages, his fill-in work with Foreigner, and his monthly column in Guitar World magazine. In addition to releasing three solo albums, in 2015, Joel released the critically acclaimed debut from his side project, Joel Hoekstra's 13, that was called Dying to Live. Here's a small sampling of some of the people Joel's performed, played, and recorded with. And I had to cut this down dramatically because we'd never get the interview going. Dee Snider from Twisted Sister, Jeff Scott Soto, Jim Petrick. I always mess up his name. I got that right. Jim Petrick from Ides of March and Survivor. Michael Sweet from Striper. Mickey Thomas from Starship. Don Barnes from 38 Special. Amy Lee from Evanescence. Eric Martin from Mr. Big. Kip Winger, Joan Jett, Rick Emmett, Tommy Shaw, Robin Zander, Derek St. Holmes, Alan Parsons. That's a classic guy, man. Jolynn Turner from Rainbow and Deep Purple. Donnie and Johnny Van Zant. Kevin Cronin from REO Speedwagon, Stephen Piercy from Rat, Mike Reno from Loverboy, Nancy Wilson, Steven Adler, Sebastian Bach, Nugent, Glenn Hughes, Wyclef Sheen, Martha Davis from Motels, Mark Slaughter, Nuno Betancourt, Henry Paul, Ray Parker Jr., Debbie Gibson, Tom Kiefer from Cinderella, and Mark Farner from Grand Funk Railroad. He's also done a lot of theater. He's done Rock of Ages, Broadway and Off-Broadway, Love, Janice, Off-Broadway, San Francisco, and a bunch of other places, and he's a monster player. Joel, thank you so much for your time, man.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. And he also has, like, probably the most awesome hair of anyone who's been on the show. You know, maybe you and, you and Doug Bossi are actually, like, neck and neck now, man. You know.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. Man, when did you move to New York, and, like, what prompted that move? Because that's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, that was the top of 2001. So I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago and little time in LA from basically 19 to 21 years of age, and then back to Chicago. And anyway, I was gigging with this girl, Kathy Richardson, with her band, and she landed the role of Janis Joplin in the show called Love, Janis. And so after it ran in Chicago, which I wasn't a part of, she was headed to New York to do it. And I basically lobbied and said, you know, hey, I'd like to do that. You know, it'd be so cool. And got an audition and got the gig. And so there you go. So I moved out to do that show called Love, Janis. It's sort of the long-winded explanation. And it ended up running 2 years. So by the time it closed, I was kind of like, well, I guess I live in New York now. I never had any desire to move to New York in my lifetime. I never thought I'd end up there, but I'm there.
Where do you live? You live in the city?
Yeah.
Wow. Were you playing the original lines, like, or something close to the original lines of some of those Janis songs, like Summertime, yeah, for example, that long intro?
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's beautiful. That's right.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And I ended up doing gigs with Big Brother and the Holding Company through that because the music director was Sam Andrew, who passed away not too long ago, became a dear friend of mine, just a great guy. And so they basically throughout their career would always have different singers filling in for what was Janis Joplin back in the day. And a guitar player they had parted ways with, James Gurley, they always had somebody in to replace him. And they just kind of did that based on geography. You know, so if there was gigs in the New York area, I kind of became that guy. Or in some cases, it was they'll fly you across the globe. Like I went to Thailand to play with them for 2 weeks. And that was a blast. So, yeah, they became dear friends of mine. Yeah, I did the whole like, you know, SG up high playing through a Fender amp with tons of spring reverb on. It was very much unlike what I'm doing nowadays with Whitesnake. I've been through a lot of phases in my career. I think people would be shocked to, you know, see some of that and go, holy crap, that's the same guy. But, you know, it is what it is. I don't regret any of it. I made a living and had a blast playing my guitar throughout my life.
What's the most offbeat thing you might have played that people would be shocked to hear, music-wise?
Geez, how much time you got? Because, I mean, I've done everything. I've played weddings. I've done, like, background music, classical at parties. I've done background jazz duos at parties. Stuff like that is usually pretty shocking to people to find out, I guess. The fact that I've actually played the electric slide before and things like that on gigs, you know. But, again, all great learning experiences, and it helps you become a well-rounded musician.
It does, man. I don't usually ask this question, but this is a personal question because I grew up in New York, man. What's your favorite New York food?
Definitely Ray's Pizza. I'm just a huge fan. There's near my place that is just great and one of my, you know, favorite, like, I don't care if I'm fat tomorrow foods.
Yeah, the pizza in New York is like nothing else. Hey, so for each of these situations, Joel, I was wondering if you could talk about how you got the gig and maybe a cool experience about working with this particular individual. Let's start with Alan Parsons.
Well, you know, my bio sort of includes all the way from people I've just played on stage with one time through other things like Scrap Metal or Jim Peterick's World Stage. You know, there were guys who'd come out and I'd be in the house band, which that's the case for Alan Parsons, all the way to, you know, things that bands that I've spent 7 or 8 years with or whatever. So Alan Parsons was just a one-time deal. He played on Jim Peterick's World Stage and you know, super nice guy, got the opportunity to play his hits to them and have him hang out afterwards and be able to, you know, schmooze with them a little bit and talk. And that was a blast for me.
Cool. How about Dee Snider?
So Dee is a little variety of things because number one, he was in the show Rock of Ages towards, I guess about 2/3 of the way through me being a part of that show. This is the over 6 years I did that show. So Dee was in it for a minute as the club owner, played an actual character in it, not himself. And, then we ended up doing some, a couple of gigs that was under the moniker when he had that Dee Does Broadway album. So it's just Dee Snider, Dee Does Broadway. And then when he kind of ditched that and it was just Dee Snider, I did like a gig or two for his solo band. So we've played together a few times. Great guy, good friend. And, you know, hopefully we'll do more down the line.
Did you play like around the New York area? Cause I know he's like a Long Island guy.
Yeah, they one of the gigs, the Dee Snider, I remember being in the Midwest somewhere though too. I can't remember where offhand.
And how'd you get the Rock of Ages?
Yeah, the Rock of Ages thing kind of came about through my philosophy of just working to stay busy at all times. I have a friend that lives a couple blocks from me in New York City who's a pit musician. He plays in the pits, and he said, hey, would you ever consider doing that? And I was like, man, I haven't really done like the whole, you know, reading 300 pages of music since high school doing that kind of thing. I don't know if I'm the guy. And he's like, no, don't worry. We'll get you audio. You practice the book for a few weeks. And then whenever I need you, you know, I'll call you and you come in. And so anyway, I subbed for him on all the shows he did for a little period there. And one of the shows, the last show I subbed for him was called Tarzan that Phil Collins wrote the music for. And basically, the keyboard player for that show became the music supervisor for Rock of Ages. So it was through like playing like traditional pit music in the pit and not even being up on stage that got me Rock of Ages. It's funny how sometimes things like that work out. And trust me, those other ones made no financial sense whatsoever. I put in hours and hours of work to get in once in a while to make, like, you know, I think a base salary thing, you make about $275 to play a pitch show or something like that. So if you've practiced for a month to get a book together and you make $275, you're way below minimum wage. Yeah. So sometimes you do stuff like that, and then all of a sudden I get this Rock of Ages show that lasts over 6 years. So it all paid off in the end.
That's great, man. Where did you just mentioned that you've always had the philosophy of staying busy. Where did that come from?
I don't know. Maybe my parents, I would say. That would probably be the closest thing.
They were hustlers?
To knowing why. Yeah, I think my mom definitely is a hard worker. So I'd say my mom.
Yeah. Because that's not like, I think.
Now I sound like a professional athlete, right?
What's that?
Well, now I sound like a professional athlete, right? Just want to my mom.
No, because, I mean, though that's not inherent in everybody, obviously. I mean, you meet people all day long, they're like, God, that guy's so lazy. And I mean, you have to, it takes work and it takes, you know, that has to be your thing to hustle. Like, that's a deliberate thing. It's not like a random
thing. Well, you,
thing,
especially you know? Going into music, you better have that attitude. Otherwise, you don't stand even close to a chance. Yeah. I mean, it's. You know, you're facing like a tidal wave that's coming through a window that's very narrow. So if you can't, you know, you somehow got to not only get through the closing window, but while a tidal wave is smacking you in the face, trying to push you back in. So
I like that analogy. And then lastly, how'd you get the gig with Whitesnake? And what's maybe some wacky or bizarre rock and roll story you could talk about with them without naming names?
So yeah, Whitesnake was kind of a combination of me putting out some feelers for it, and then a couple of people putting my name for it at David Coverdale. Most importantly, Phil Carson, who manages Foreigner, and actually Dee Snider. So Phil and I first met when Dee was in Rock of Ages, but Phil also tapped me in 2011 when Night Ranger was opening for Foreigner and Journey. When Mick Jones got sick, so I filled in for Mick Jones and Foreigner, and I learned it in a day, and I think that really like opened Phil's eyes, and he went like, wow, this guy's, you know, did a really great job on short notice. So when David needed somebody, I just thought, well, who would David respect that I could have send him an email where that would turn his head a little more than just getting like a, you know, a video link from somebody, you know, a musician or something. So that's how I got an audition, and everything worked out from there.
Wow, that's great, man. Well, it's good that how you made that happen, which is, you know, that's the real cool story of it, you know. I have a question. What's the most, the raunchiest or most bizarre rock and roll story over your career? Again, not looking for gossip, not looking for names, just something that's like, you know.
Well, certainly most of them, you know, that I can't repeat come from Reb Beach, you know, my guitar partner, Whitesnake. He's just like, I mean, there's stuff that I hear from Reb on the tour bus that I can't unhear, you know, that's changed my life for the worse. But he's got a really funny one actually that I can tell about with Alice Cooper having the giant snake back when Reb was in Alice Cooper's band, and the snake, which apparently they barely ever do this, took a shit on Reb's pedal board during the show, and apparently a snake shit smells like beyond anything you've ever smelled in your life. It's so bad. So Reb, I guess, motioned for his guitar tech to help with it, and I guess it smelled so bad that when the guy was cleaning it up, he threw up on Reb's pedal board. So he had the snake shit and vomit on his pedal board.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's pretty raunchy and disgusting. There's one I can tell.
Yeah.
And trust me, others are just as bad, and I can't tell them.
Well, cool. Thanks, man. Hey, what are you working on now that you're excited about?
Well, I just came from Reno actually helping a little bit with the Whitesnake mixes. So there's a new album coming out called Flesh and Blood. Yes, I know Poison used the title. No big surprise there, but David has a vision. So we've got, I think, a September release date now at this point, because David had a little serious bout actually with the flu that really wiped him out for a bit. The flu that's going around these days is just nasty. So right around the time we were going to shoot the video, it took him down. But there's going to be a video for the single coming out in May. And it's a real diverse album, though. The single, I'm kind of disappointed there's only one video, because it really only shows one side of what the album is, which I think is a nice blend for, you know, all the Whitesnake fans. There's some traditional kind of old school stuff. There's stuff that sounds more like the, you know, Geffen records and everything in between, and even some uncharted territory, I think, for the band. So it's a nice diverse album, and looking forward to it.
And that's it's a September release date, you reckon?
September release. I don't know the exact one at this point. I don't even know if there is an exact one at this point, but I think right around that time frame.
Awesome. And name again, Joel? Sorry. Blood.
So the album is Flesh and Blood.
Awesome.
With the "and" being an ampersand, not word.
That's cool.
I know this, I'm trying to get guitar picks made. You know, you don't want to have your guitar picks represent the wrong thing. So
I hear that.
Anyway.
Well, cool, man. Well, good luck with the record. And if you want to come on here to promote it when it comes out, you're more than welcome. You've been involved in so many different projects. And I was curious, I mean, like, really, like, you know, all that hustling is, you know, paid off. You've done a ton of great stuff with loads of people. And I was curious, what would you say, like, are the top three musical experiences you've had? Meaning, like, which ones left you feeling most satisfied musically?
That's really hard to answer because they're all different. You know, it's like finishing albums always feels really good because it's like you work really hard on something, and the anticipation of having people hear it and what they're going to think of it is always, I think, special. So definitely each of my albums. I'm not going to give you a top three. I'm just going to give you kind of maybe some of the things that pop out. The gigs that are under the wire and under pressure, you know, like with Night Ranger, I didn't have any rehearsals with them. I had to fill in basically as an audition to get the gig, and it was like learning 25 songs and going in and playing the gig on no rehearsal and a very limited sound check. So it's like, you know, those gigs are like jumping out of a plane and not knowing if your parachute works, you know, and then when it does, you're like, oh, thank God. When it goes well, and the aforementioned Foreigner fill in because that was under such duress, you know, just doing that 24-hour period of learning their set and then flying down to Virginia Beach, and the gig was in front of 18,000 people with, you know, everybody from the tour on the side of the stage going, let's see how this works out. You know, Neil Sean, like literally 10 feet from me with his arms crossed, checking it out, and me going, fuck, I just learned this, you know. Yeah. I can't swear on this, right?
Is that acceptable? You can say whatever you want. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And if you don't, I will do it.
those moments stick out for me. But the music business is not one big break. It's funny when people talk about their big break, and it's really just a series of hard-earned small breaks that the way it works. And sure, some can work out larger. I'm not saying that, you know, there can't be some kind of big breaks for people, but they're usually a lot more hard-earned than people realize. Hmm.
It's interesting. I've noticed that as a guy coming from the business world where it's the exact same thing, it's not – you know, maybe once in a while it's one thing, but it's usually a series of small incremental things that kind of add up and open another door that wouldn't have been available to you. But it's very similar, you know, running your small business, which is playing guitar.
Yep. It's, you know, you got to look at it realistically. Let's say, you know, just for instance, if The Edge was out of U2, tomorrow or something, but they said, we want to continue on, we want a new guitar player. Well, they're not going to hire a guy unless he's already been playing for huge audiences and is familiar with the landscape of the whole thing and understands how to be a professional. So they're going to hire from peers that are right around their level of success, which is immensely hard when you're U2 to think about. We could have used the Lindsey Buckingham analogy, right? Because he just got back from Fleetwood Mac. But, you know, they're not going to pick a kid as amazing as he is in his basement, even if the kid is an amazing player. So you need to take that step by step professionally. You know, the career building takes just as long as the playing building. It's they're not always the same thing. You can be an amazing player and not have a great career, and vice versa.
Man, that is really accurate. You said career building takes just as long as what was it?
Building your playing.
Yeah, building your. I think that's very accurate. So you know that's why, and I don't know if you want to go talk about this or not. And if you don't, that's totally cool. Like, you see guys on YouTube that have, like, you know, they're, quote, YouTube sensations, but they're in their house.
Well, yeah, that's where you're going to use it. There's a sensationalistic factor that's there on YouTube that just doesn't play for longer than 5 minutes in real life. So if you want to charge money and, you know, besides monetizing your YouTube, I guess, you know, if you want to put on a concert, an hour of that can kind of get like, well, where's the music for the common man, you know? So I've kind of tried to avoid a lot of that. I mean, I do lessons for Guitar World, and there's some stuff of me up like that, but I try not to be the guy who's like, let me set up my video camera today and make 9 million YouTubes of me shredding and things like that. It's just kind of not, I don't know, I'd rather become known as a good guitar player through the real world of playing music.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. I agree. Hey, so you're originally from Chicago, you said. What was childhood like?
What was what like?
Your childhood, growing up.
Oh, my childhood. I'm sorry. I couldn't understand you. Yeah, so, you know, I was a suburban kid. And interestingly enough, like, I lived in a pretty blue-collar neighborhood, but my parents were classical musicians, and hence not being so well-to-do that we were in, like, a, you know, a fancy or rich neighborhood. So, you know, it was all good, though, man. I had good friends and you know, just into sports, like, a lot of really young kids. And then when I found guitar at the age of 11, everything kind of took off, and I became a little more isolated, you know, because I was so into that, and it was kind of like, you know, took me off into my own world a little bit.
You said both of your parents were classical musicians.
Yeah.
What did they play?
Piano and organ, conducting.
So obviously that was a huge influence on you.
Yeah, in that there was music around the house all the time. They did get me going on cello at 3 and piano at 7, and I wasn't any good. I don't want to make people think I was playing, you know, Bach when I was 3 years old. I was playing Old MacDonald Had a Farm. The point is I think it developed my sense of pitch and rhythm and learning how to read music and things like that. So when I started guitar at 11, my ear, like, I learned a power chord, and my ear could already take me to playing a million songs, because I went, oh, I hear it now. That's all you do is move this chord around. And so, like, instantly I knew most Black Sabbath songs and things like that. So,
which is
the benefits from it.
Yeah, that's probably served you very well over your career.
It did, definitely. I think, you know, having that, learning music at a young age is really important, because your brain is just developing. I mean, allegedly you're really supposed to have some kind of music education beginning at 3 to really, you know, make it all happen. But no complaints, man. It gave me a nice jump start.
Cool. When did you know you wanted to play professionally?
It's funny. I never feel like I made that decision, you know, or never thought it would work out, but I just kind of kept going. But immediately would be the answer. Like, as soon as I started at 11, I think I was so motivated. I was just doing that all the time. And I think I began kind of making some money at it at 14. I was teaching some guitar lessons already. So after only playing for whatever, 3 years, I already had my first guitar students. And, you know, I held down some other jobs along the way there early on, but I definitely knew that I never made the decision. I was very lucky in that sense. You know, most people have to labor over what they're going to do with their life, you know, but I had to labor through people going, what? And, you know, being treated like a loser because you're going into it. And,
really?
You know, it's things took off from, well, that's the nature of going into something like that when you live in the suburbs. You know, people are like, they expect you to go into something where it's like guaranteed you're going to make good money, and, you know, not like something in the arts where it's like, what? Like, you're going into that? Like, that you're mental. Times have changed a little bit with that, too. Nowadays, it's a little more respected for some reason. But I think, you know, when I was young, that was considered like, good luck with that, you know? Like, that's never going to work out. Wow. And certainly, you know, when your peers are graduating from college and immediately making salaries and have jobs, the girls tend to like them a lot more than the guy who's playing in bars, like, a little bit and barely making money. And, you know, so it is what it is. All good, though. No regrets on any of it, man.
I would bet you redeemed that end of it over the years, no?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It's all good, man.
You know, everybody pays tuition in our careers, and I was, you know, wondering if you'd be kind enough to share one or two mistakes you might have made along the way and what lessons you learned from them, if you did make them.
I mean, there's only really one big one I can think of, and that's just like having the confidence to realize if you just work hard at something, you're going to be fine. That's the ultimate lesson I could pass on to younger kids starting. You know, it's just all about the work you put in. People are really into this whole like feeling like victims when they're trying to learn an instrument and why they can't be good at it. Well, the only real reason is they're not spending enough time. They're not working hard enough, because I've never met a guitar player who played 8 hours a day every day that sucked. They're usually fucking amazing, and that's fine. And if you're amazing, you've got some ability to, you know, now again, that comes to the other side. What do you do with that to be able to make a living? But that takes work too. So you have to find the balance between working on your playing and make sure that you're at a level that you're able to make some money with it. And the better you are, the better opportunity you have to do that. And then how hard you work at marketing that and turning that into a situation where you're building a career and building upon it, being good with people. That's really, really important, being good with people. It all pays off in the end. So, but again, I guess confidence and just not thinking that it's like this, you know, you're in the right place at the right time. People use that all the time. Well, he was in the right place at the right time, or he got a lucky break. You know, that's all bullshit.
It is bullshit.
All those things are bullshit. It's just a matter of how hard you've worked at each of the things I'm talking about, the developing your playing and developing your career.
Where did that being good with people, that is a really important thing. And I think because everybody's wrapped up in technology, that's a skill set that is dying. How did you particularly develop your skills with people?
It's you know, I mean, this is going to sound like kind of like I'm a religious zealot, but I'm going to just say it because I think it's true. But it's like, you know, growing up, going to church and all that stuff, you know, instills a humility in you that you realize you've admitted that there's something bigger than you in your life. I think a lot of people haven't admitted that there's anything bigger than them, and that people think they're perfect sometimes. And, you know, you have to realize you're imperfect and be able to say, I'm sorry, and or say also let go of some of your visions of things when you're in a band. You know, if there's five guys in a band, I like to say you only really get your way 20% of the time. Yeah. If you're doing more than that, you're probably being a dick. And the other guys probably don't like you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can voice your opinion, but realistically, if you're in a democracy in a band, it's things like that, you know, not holding your ideas and thinking that you're the end all be all. So you have to have some level of humility to be good with people. And that certainly factors in when you're dealing with people who are technically the boss. Like, you know, when I worked in Night Ranger, having Jack, Brad, and Kelly, guys that spent 30 some years building up that band, you know, who would I have been to say this is what needs to happen with Night Ranger? And there are people who are delusional enough to do these things when they get gigs or opportunities that just don't understand that you're working for them and you're there to make them happy and you do your best. And oftentimes these guys can be very generous, you know, and it's the same with David Coverdale and Whitesnake. You know, David spent 40 years building up Whitesnake, and, you know, that's not to say that each of these scenarios, those guys weren't generous and give you opportunities to have creative input or even at times business input, but those had that opportunity has to come from them.
Yeah.
And, it's just the understanding that where you sit, you having a good picture of where you really are in terms of the business, and having respect for it too, not just being like bitter about it. There's some people can I guess picture it, but they're just mad the whole time about it. And I'm not.
No, it sounds like you've got a really healthy sense of, you know, I make choices and I'm responsible for the outcome of the choice I make. And I'm also responsible to behave a certain way based on a particular choice I make.
Well, that's all. Those are all complete 100% truths. I mean, there can be variables in life that would, you know, turn you into an existentialist. I mean, I could walk out, turn the corner and have a semi come veering out of a lane and slam into me, you know, and that obviously wasn't within my control. But we certainly control the majority of what happens in our lives, I do believe.
No, I agree with you. And I think it's almost critical to look for. Like for me, even when bad shit happens, I always try to you know, look for what was my role in that, you know, because number one, you learn, but number two, you don't feel like a victim. You're like, okay, well, I fucked that up because, you know, I should have been smarter, whatever, you know, I hate.
I think people sometimes are more comfortable as victims, you know, so mentally it makes them feel good about themselves in a weird way, even though you're pitying yourself, it's sort of giving yourself comfort. And it's like, it's important to try to avoid it.
Oh,
I'm not saying, look, I don't bat 1,000 on any of this stuff. I'm not, you know, I'm not preaching to people. I'm just saying what I've learned and what I try to avoid. And a lot of it does come down to this stuff that we're talking about. It's way more important than whether or not you learn to sweep a B7, you know, a B7 flat 5 arpeggio.
I agree with you 100%, man. Flip side of that question is, are there one or two particular things you did that at the time might have been out of your comfort zone but turned into really big breaks for you?
Well, that's been a lot of stuff, you know, like kind of every step of the way is always a little bit of a learning experience every time there's a transition. If I had to put my finger on a moment, there was like not going to say it was out of my wheelhouse, but I remember getting the Trans-Siberian Orchestra audition and landing the gig. And at the time I was already a Night Ranger and had Rock of Ages. And I thought, well, how the hell am I going to do this? Cause I'll have to sub out of Night Ranger for November, December, which I've never done. They'll probably fire me if I say I can't be a part of the gigs in November, December. Rock of Ages, it wasn't a problem. I could sub that out, but I was starting to go, is this too much? Am I taking on too much? Is it all going to fall down like a house of cards, you know, if I take this on? I get fired from Night Ranger and maybe TSO doesn't work out and the Rock of Ages closes 6 months later. And I'm going, oh, my God, I thought I had three things and now I have none. But it worked out, you know, taking on the TSO thing and going through that actually really built. And I just did my best to have clear lines of communication with the Night Ranger guys and be able to sub that out and continue to build. And all of those things have, you know, TSO, that's really paid off for me now. I mean, I'm in, I guess, year 9 of it right now.
Wow. Are you something in the like East or that. West?
East.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so to be that far in with it, you know, that was a huge decision. And I remember in the moment thinking, like, should I even be saying I can do this? Because I don't know if I can. And, you know, obviously it was a very smart decision to forge forward with it.
So you had a lot of like negative self-talk or chatter going on up there, and you just said, you know, let me fight through it, sort of.
I don't know about negative, but just trying to weigh it through. Like, how's it, you know, how's that going to work? Am I going to, you know, and I just kind of had to have faith that hopefully people would value me enough to keep me around, you know, mainly Night Ranger at that time. Just go, hopefully there's a way for me to have somebody else come in for me November, December and be able to still be doing this. And that did work out for that period.
That's awesome. If you've been doing this a while, if you had to go back and give advice to, you know, young Joel, what would you have told him?
It's just the confidence thing. I could give you a short answer, but that's definitely it. The working hard. That's just the whole secret.
All right, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. What's your how many guitars do you have? First of all, I can't even imagine.
I actually don't know. It's not that much for you know, what you would think. I think I'm in the 30s somewhere.
Wow. That's really reasonable.
Honestly. Yeah, it is. It's really reasonable. Yeah. I mean, I live in New York City. My place is not big, you know. So, but I have some guitars out with Whitesnake's gear that just live in LA. The guitars I had custom made for that gig. Currently, I have some guitars in Vegas that I use for the Share gig and the rest are basically in my house, you know. Sans my original guitar, but my second guitar, which is in my mom's garage in Florida. But that's it, man. So I would need to count. I don't know.
What's like your go-to guitar right now, and what other two guitars might round out your top three?
Well, my gold top Les Paul has been the one that's sort of meant the most to me over the years. Even when I don't use it on stage, like I don't use it on stage with Whitesnake or TSO, it's always with me on tour. I practice on it and warm up, and that's what I prepare for almost every gig on at home. And so it's my main guitar, even though I don't really use it on. I use it with the share gig right now a little bit, but it doesn't get used with Whitesnake or TSO. But it is my main guitar, and I did like use it on the whole Whitesnake album and my whole previous album, the Joel Hoekstra's 13 album.
Is that with P90s, or you have humbuckers in there?
No, just the humbuckers. Yeah, the burst buckers it came with.
What would be like number two and three?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So I guess I would round it out with, I really like the custom guitars I had made for Whitesnake. So I'm just going to keep going with Les Pauls, probably the white and the black one with those. And, there's a white custom that doesn't have any of that stuff on it that I play with TSO that I really like a lot too. So, but it's all Les Pauls. Yeah. One, three are all Les Pauls.
That's very cool, man. Do you have any weird or interesting stories behind how you acquired any of those?
Not really. I mean, I'm not a big trader, seller, or anything like that. I mean, having the custom Whitesnake guitars was a challenge because when I joined the band, I was like, I want to start with all new gear and not come out with the gold top, which Doug Aldrich was sort of, that was his signature guitar in the band all his years. And then you can already read the fan complaints before you're even, recorded one note that, oh, look at this guy. He thinks he's trying to be Doug with his gold top. So I thought it served me well to have my own thing going on. But I definitely wanted to play Les Pauls because I like the sound, and I think that's a huge part of Whitesnake, period, is that Les Paul sound. So anyway, I reached out to Gibson. I had the idea of having medallions set in two Les Pauls, and then we were doing the Purple album at the time, so I wanted to have strats done too. So I had these gold medallions made at a mint that have the Whitesnake emblem, and I had Gibson lay them into two, a white and black custom Les Paul, and they did this cool kind of abstract snake stencil on the top that almost looks like Asian writing in a way. And then Fender did the same thing for me with a couple of US strats. And then my friends at Atomic Guitars did this amazing purple crystal guitar with a gold crystal WS on the top that, people can check these out online. They're all over the place. But those guitars were all special. It was a special time just creating the whole thing of new gear and coming in with five brand new guitars for a gig was really fun.
Yeah, but gets you pretty enthusiastic. Have you ever sold a guitar you wish you can get back?
Only my first one, because I did that to buy my second one when I was a kid. And my mom sold it to a coworker in the suburb of Hinsdale, Illinois. And then years later, I used to teach in basically Darien. I guess that was in Darien. I'm trying to think what town that the store was in that I taught in. But it was in the Hinsdale area. Somebody came in with that style of guitar for lessons. I used to teach 70 students a week, and a lot of them were
beginners. Holy crap.
So this kid comes in with that guitar, and I went, man, where'd you get that? And he said, at this store in Hinsdale. And I went, I wonder if the person who bought it from us sold it to this store or sold it on consignment there. And this kid said it had a lot of fret wear on it, which beginner guitars like that normally don't, because kids don't practice that much, So I had the thought, man, I wonder if that's my first guitar, but how would I know? And I couldn't buy it because I couldn't say with certainty that it was.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, it's a drag not to have my first guitar.
Let's talk about Desert Island Discs, man. If you had to pick your – no, I want to ask you influences. Is there anybody that influenced you musically and playing-wise that – out of the ordinary, people be surprised to hear?
Yeah, well, the parents, and then Angus Young was the visual, I want to start because that guy's awesome and I want to be like him. And then there's lesser known guys that were big influences on me. My second guitar teacher, who went on to have a guitar career himself, TJ Helmerich, who's an amazing player and engineer and great friend of mine. And that's somebody who people would be like, who? I don't know who he is, except guitar players. A lot of guitar players know who he is. But he was a big influence on me. And then also Brett Garsid, who TJ made albums with, was a big influence on me. And, that's somebody who, again, a lot of people aren't like, you mean it's not, the stock list of players, but those are two guys that people haven't heard of as much that were huge influences on me.
Very cool. Desert Island Discs. If I asked you to pick your top three CDs or albums, in no particular order, and knowing this can change tomorrow, like, what's your knee-jerk reaction? What would be your top three records?
That's a tough one. I mean, I might go with, like, mellower stuff, just because I'd be on a desert island. But I always say the Eagles' greatest hits with this would be a good one, because there's so many good songs. And I'd have to go with Back in Black if I wanted to rock out, and maybe I'd go with The Wall for, you know, if there were any mushrooms growing on the island.
I hear you, man. I remember when I got that record, it was like really mind-blowing, you know? It was
The Wall is amazing. Yeah. It's an amazing album, yeah.
But I felt that way when I listened to Dark Side of the Moon and Wish You Were Here as well. So
I connected with The Wall much more for some reason. I don't know why. I mean, Dark Side of the Moon is more popular, but The Wall, for whatever reason, was one that connected with me more.
Let's talk about you. What's something that you learned about yourself along this journey?
That's kind of a tough one. I guess I would just say it'd be the confidence thing again, that I didn't have a lot, and I should have.
I appreciate you sharing that. I think that's not an uncommon thing for people
in general. It's not. I think, you know, young people, it's very rare to be super confident. But I think in the end, if you just learn, if you work really hard, there's no reason not to be confident.
What do you like most about yourself, man?
That I know I'm far from perfect.
That's a good answer. I like that. And if you could change one thing about yourself, what would that be?
There's a lot. I mean, I'd like to do better, and we're always striving to do better in every area of our life. So it's very tough for me to put the finger on one thing, but it's just doing better at all the areas of my life that would enhance my life.
Are you a type A personality?
What is that? You'll have to put it down for me. I'm not that smart.
Oh, no. Type A personalities, like, you know, very driven, fairly intense, ambitious, go-getter type, got a lot of things going on.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm probably a mix of the two. You know, I think I do that without being overly aggressive and dickish, though. You know, yeah. I would never screw anybody over to get ahead, or I would never. You know, all that stuff kind of comes, like, for instance, I don't put money first. I don't put, like, I want to be rich in life. I put guitar first, and I let the money come from that. I don't do anything else outside of that. I don't put my efforts into, you know, I get people all the time, well, you should invest, man. You should go into do real estate or the stock market. It's like, I don't want to do that. It's going to divide my attention from what I do. I don't need to be a gazillionaire. I just want to do what I do. That's my definition of success, is getting through life, being able to do this. That's it.
Best childhood memory?
I'm going to go outside of the guitar thing and just say, I remember Christmas getting Atari when that came out, and that was awesome. And just, like, you know, going to church, but couldn't wait to get home from church to play Space Invaders. There's something, like, extra fun about that time period, about getting that.
Very cool. Space Invaders was awesome. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I have a lot of anxiety on stage. You know, I'm a very nervous guy. And so that's something people always say, oh, you're so good on stage. I'm like, I'm always so fucking nervous. Like, you know, every gig of my life, it's something I've fought and battled. So that's usually something that surprises people.
Yeah, that is surprising. You seem like a very even tempered guy, man. You know, like you said, you know, you're a mix of both. And I could see that, because you're definitely very driven and a hustler, but you're like, you don't seem like super intense. You're very, very even keel, very mellow.
I think when people suffer from that, it's because maybe the gig is overly important to them, which I think stems back to me growing up playing music and, you know, just at such a young age and everything like that, that it's just so instilled in me. I think I just look at all this stuff with such wide eyes, like, about how, you know, I'm just so into it all, that I make too big a deal of it in my head. And, you know, I think that's where it stems from.
Sure, sure. Do you have any non-musical superpowers?
Pretty good at basketball. I played from like a lot of like going to the YMCA and stuff like that, being from 19 years old all the way till I kind of stopped right about 30, but I did like, I used to go about every day. So I got good there for a minute. I'm pretty rusty now.
You look like a big guy. You're tall, right? I would imagine you look like pretty
tall. I'm 6'3".
Yeah.
I'm 6'3". But I did get good at basketball for a minute. And when I was a kid, I was a great pitcher in Little League. I was like the top pitcher in the league. And so there's, you know, other stuff I'm good at. And I, in grade school, I did a lot of cartooning, doodling, and drawing. So I'm a pretty decent artist too.
That's a really I draw a little bit. That's a very relaxing thing to do. I find it super relaxing, man.
Yeah, I guess so. I mainly do it for my kids nowadays more than anything. If, you know, they're like, "Dad, can you draw this for me?" That's kind of become a thing. And I'll draw it for them and we'll hang it up on the wall so they have it.
Cool. Biggest business or personal win?
Just getting this far. That's pretty much it, man. It's all those little steps. So it's, again, there's never like the one moment, but getting this far would be huge.
Any bad habits?
I'll just go with like eating. Eating is like, you know, something that I still use as a reward, and it's, I'm not very rational about it, you know.
Dude, you must have great metabolism because you look like a like super fit, thin dude. So,
I do exercise. I love to exercise. And I do 6 days a week. I've been through a lot of phases, though, with weight in my life. I've been, you know, like 20, 30 pounds heavier than I am right now. And you know, I've done that extreme weight loss thing a couple times in my life where I'll drop like 40 pounds and where I'll make a huge difference. And so that's from the eating thing. I'm just, you know, born with a huge appetite, I guess. I just love eating. So it's been difficult for me to maintain.
What kind of working out do you do? Do you do cardio or lift weights or both or?
It's mainly like a in-room calisthenic driven thing because I didn't want to have an out on the road to say, "Oh, there's no gym in this hotel, I can't work out," or whatever. So I kind of created something that wouldn't let myself get out of that. That being said, if there is a gym nowadays, I like to go hit the gym because it's less reps and things like that. But no, I mix it up. I mean, I usually work out. It's like a, you know, good 40 minute workout or something like that. But
that's,
it's
great.
Combination of upper body, lower body, core, and stretching.
Good for you, man. That's awesome. You have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
It's like, you know, pretty normal guy stuff, sports and movies. That's my release from it. I really am a big Cubs fan right now. They have a good team, so I'm, you know, very into that. And the Bulls with basketball, who, you know, really grabbed me growing up during the, you know, the Jordan Pippen years and everything. That was the 6 championships, and they're not as good nowadays, but I still find myself following them every day. And movies, I'm one of those guys that when I find great movies, I'll watch them over and over and over. And so I have a list of movies that's, I don't know how deep, but probably 100 movies or so that I'll just watch at any time.
Cool. You've been in New York since 2001, and you haven't like been a Yankee fan or a Rangers fan or a Jets fan?
No. I tried the sports is a big deal in Chicago. It's a huge deal there. So, you know, I look, after the Bulls Knicks stuff with me growing up, I could never be a Knicks fan.
It's hard to root for the Knicks, and I'm a Knicks fan.
I tried that when I moved to New York. I thought, well, they're in the American League. The Cubs are in the National. I could root for the Yankees and be a Yankees fan until the should they ever meet in the World Series or play each other in the regular season. And it just didn't work. They're too, you know, they just, it's all that money. They just pay for their whole team, and there's just no development there. It's just kind of annoying more than anything.
Speaking of Yankees, have you ever crossed paths in Guitar World with Bernie? I'm having a brain fart now. What's that? Yeah. Have you ever crossed?
Yeah. He mentioned me in his book, which I was blown away. I mean, we never met. But I read in his book, you know, it's him talking about going to see a Night Ranger concert. And he said their guitar player, Joel Hoekstra, is amazing or whatever. And I was like, I can't believe I'm reading that. That's insane.
That's really cool.
No, I just played with another guitar player who actually plays in Bernie's band.
Gil.
Gil, exactly.
Yeah. I interviewed Gil. Yeah, I think he's the one who introduced you to me.
Oh, okay. Right on. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. He plays with Bernie all the time.
Yeah. So everybody that I know that's worked with him, because my friend Joel Rosenblatt has worked with him before too, says, you know, he's a super nice guy, but we've never met. But I'd love to sometime, obviously, and not necessarily off of the baseball thing, but just to, you know, play chat guitar or whatever and pick his brain. But that's cool.
Who's had the biggest influence on your life?
I'll go with the sports figure answer again. My mom. It'd have to be, right? Because your patterns are set all the way from being an infant with that. So it's got to be.
Most important lesson your business has taught you?
Not to make too big a deal over one thing.
Yeah, it's a real valuable lesson.
You can tell yourself, people just don't care. You always care about your personal scenarios about 100 times more than the world cares. And that's why people flippantly make, you know, keyboard warrior comments and things like that. They usually just don't care as much as you. They think they're just making a little comment.
Yeah.
And you're like, what? You know, when you read bad stuff about yourself. And so it's you got to just realize people just don't care at the same level.
100%. And I think it's ridiculous. And I think it's actually foolish to assume otherwise. You know, I mean, why would they?
Yeah, well, I would.
When it comes down to it. Two more questions, man. Best advice you've ever been given and by who?
Best advice I've ever been given. You know, I don't know who necessarily gave it to me, but so again, I'll take it back to the church thing. Sorry to be overly religious on you in this interview, but I think it's just to be able to forgive people is, I think, a lost art and very important these days. People are like really not good at that nowadays. Everybody thinks that they're perfect and never makes a mistake. And, you know, the ability to say you're sorry for something, because I recognize the fact that I haven't always done exactly what I've wanted. I mean, far from it. You know, there's lots of stuff in my life where I'm like, why did I say that? Or why did I do that? And, you know, so I think the ability to say I'm sorry and to also forgive people who maybe, you know, on paper you'd say, well, they screwed me over. They did me wrong. You know, it's like, it's really important to let go of that stuff. There's nothing that's been done to me in this world that I can't let go of.
And if you don't let go of that shit, man, it just sits inside and festers you. It's not good.
Yeah, I'll kill you.
There's nothing good about that, man.
Well, it really is true what goes around comes around. That's such a true saying, because if you think about it, if I was rude to you in conversation right now, you're not going to come back with being pleasant with me in conversation. You come back with being rude, right? So you generate that. You what you're putting out, you're going to generate back to yourself. So why not generate the fact that people would forgive me or be kind to me? I try to, you know, send that out into the world and have that come back.
You know what's really weird, man? When I hit around 50, I stopped doing that. Like, if someone was rude to me, like, and I grew up in the Bronx and I'm a typical, like, New York guy inherently like that. And I'd be like, well, fuck you. I stopped doing that altogether. And for selfish reasons, because, like, I found that, like, I said, man, if I don't react, I'm just giving me stress. So now, like, if someone does something like that to me, I either just, like, literally walk away. But I just mentally delete it, or I'll say, man, what made you say that? Like, really calm. It's really weird. Like,
you have to learn to rationalize through those moments. The world needs to learn it. I mean, it would lead us towards a lot more of no war in the world, you know, if the world leaders could kind of rationalize through things and go, look, hi. But again, a lot of stuff, they like to pin that on religion, but it all comes down to money. That most of that stuff basically comes down to arguing over money, the world leaders. So anyway, talking about bigger stuff than, you know, a guy who plays guitar here. But
or me. I hear you. Yeah. Last question, man, and you've really been a pleasure, and I appreciate your time. What's been the biggest change in your personality over, say, the last 7 to 10 years? And how much of this change has been deliberate, like you working on it, and how much is just a natural part of aging?
I think it's all a natural part of aging, man, but I'm always trying to learn. And the biggest change, geez, I don't know, man. That's really hard to say because 7 to 10 years, there's been a lot of changing. I'm constantly evolving, I think, and trying to do better as a person. And so, sorry, it's hard to give you like a one thing.
No, that's totally cool, man. Just keeping it real. That's the best thing here. Man, I can't thank you enough for everything. Let's tell people where they can find you. First of all, September, the new Whitesnake album is coming out. It's called Flesh and Blood. Where else could people find you? And like, where can they find out where to see you on in tour and on gigs?
Okay, so I have a very difficult name, but I'm going to spell it for you. As it's a, I'm going to tell you, direct you to my .com here. But JoelHoekstra. So joelhoekstra.com, and you can link over to any of my social media stuff from there, and actually have a pretty comprehensive website that people can take a look at and learn a lot about me. So maybe they'll pop in and give it a visit.
I would encourage everybody to check it out. His website is very detailed. And any final words of wisdom, man?
No, just, I mean, anybody that's come to a show or bought a recording or anything like that, thanks for the support, because that's what it's all about, just trying to get this far and get through life doing this, and it's all good.
Thank you so much for everything, man. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, brother.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Joel Hoekstra for spending time with us. Please check him out online. It's Joel Hoekstra, HoekStra.com. Check out the new Whitesnake album in September. It's called Flesh and Blood. And support Joel and come out and see him on tour. Go to EveryoneLovesGuitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with early product announcements and discounts. And remember, happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at EveryoneLovesGuitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.